Mark Twain scholar Alan Gribben plans to publish revised editions of Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. The scholar plans to replace the N-word, which is used more than 200 times, with the word slave, and rename Injun Joe Indian Joe.
Earlier this year, Alyssa Nutting published a novel called Tampa. It created controversy because it dared to portray a Florida teacher named Celeste Price who seduced and sexually abused her students.
Abusive racial insults that bear distinct connotations of permanent inferiority nonetheless repulse modern-day readers.
Now, I knew fairly early on that this book was going to be misunderstood, that it was going to make people angry. Earlier this year, as I was selling a few books at the Strand bookstore, I observed an obnoxious and humorless freelance book critic, someone who I'm not going to name but who has been published in several major outlets, speak very loudly about how she couldn't be bothered to make it past page 50 because she was so offended by the book. She derided Tampa in the strongest possible terms, even though she had never bothered to finish the book. I also got into an online argument with some illiterate nitwit writing for Book Riot because she, too, had condemned the book as unbelievable, even though when I challenged her on it, she couldn't cite a specific example.
It is a very much an anti-racist book, and if you leave that out, you're leaving out the impact of what you're doing.
Now, I want to be clear about two things. First off, Alyssa Nutting's Tampa is one of the best books of 2013. It is brave, vivacious, uncomfortable, and hilarious. It inhabits multiple emotions and enters into dangerous territory, as all great art must. Second, if you feel the need to condemn a book, and you can't be bothered to read that book in full or cite examples in your argument, then really, you don't have the right to venture an opinion. Get out of the discourse. You're lazy, ignorant, and uninformed. No better off than some Tea Party type who wants to hijack the national political conversation, or some drunken oaf just spilling out of some bar.
You know, they're sending a message that books are dangerous. There's something in this book we don't want you to know. We don't want to talk about what's in this book. We don't want you to ask us questions about what's in this book.
My name is Edward Champion, and this is The Bat Segundo Show. I wanted to talk with Alyssa earlier in the year when this book came out, but she was pregnant at the time. However, I did manage to talk with her during a recent trip she made to New York City. Okay, so I am here with Alyssa Nutting, who was most recently the author of Tampa. Alyssa, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. My goodness. So I wanted to go ahead and start with some of the stories in Unclean Jobs for Women and Girls, because I read this collection, and it seems to me that they were unknowing preparation for developing Celeste's character in Tampa. We see in Teenager, it depicts much of the familiarity with school-related procedures, adults who determine what behavior is appropriate, the counselor who says, I'm here to sell you all about your choices. But then you have these, and I'm out of breath because I was running around cleaning up a beer mess.
Just if, that is
if
true.
If I sound like I'm like, you know, suitably sort of one of like some of the male characters in Tampa. Anyway. But then you have these surrealistic stories like Ant Colony and Porn Star, where you're examining behavior related to intimacy in this kind of phantasmagorical context. So I'm wondering, you know, how did writing these stories force you to get at the truths of Celeste aberrant behavior or just deviant behavior in general? How did a fantastical tilt towards perversity aid you in becoming braver and truer as a writer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I've always been really attracted to female characters that are on the margins.
Yeah.
And I think that this was, I can kind of relate it to sort of immunizations, right? Where sort of, you know, you get a tiny little bit of the virus, you know, and then you build up more and more and more and more immunity.
The virus.
Yes. I think these stories were my first experience with a virus. And after I was done with all of them, I could just withstand such a walloping dose of narcissism and sociopathy that, yeah, Celeste was a pretty natural progression.
So you joined the Peace Corps, went to faraway countries, inoculated yourself of all, you know, hypothetical problems.
Right, yeah. Right.
Did you think you developed empathy for this type of scoundrel?
You know, what I did develop is this ease to see the humor in extremity,
yes,
and in perversity,
yes.
You know, I mean, that's kind of one of the questions that I get most often about Celeste. You know, is sort of to what extent do you empathize with her, or you know, not? You know, and it's funny because like I don't think Celeste cares if I empathize with her. You know, and I sort of feel a little proud, you know, that I made a character that's kind of that much beyond my judgment. You know, I mean, she just would not give a shit what I think about her or anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I think that that's kind of great. I mean, because one of the things that I explored so much in Unclean Jobs, you know, was just different sort of social pressures for women. And a lot of the characters really experienced and felt, you know, those social pressures as a form of pain, you know, because they didn't live up to them, or they didn't resonate with them, or they were not, that individual's experience of being in the world did not match, you know, sort of what they saw, you know, the behaviors that they were being asked to kind of do and emulate. You know, so I think in that way too, it was sort of a fine marriage, you know, to pair myself with someone that that just kind of was further past anyone I'd written about before.
Well, what you just said there about how Celeste really wouldn't care if you empathize with her, if the writer, if her God actually empathized with her. That is interesting to me because, you know, she is very clearly an emotional character.
Yeah.
So if you have an emotional relationship with a character, how do you do it without empathy? How do you just, you know, summon it like that? I mean, or do you feel that such moral definitions are just outside the scope of what you should be doing as a fiction writer?
Yeah, you know, and that's another huge, I think, sort of aspect of the discussion that...
The discussion.
Yes, the discussion.
the people with pitchforks calling for your demise.
Yes. And yeah, and there are many, and the pitchforks are, on fire, and there's all kinds of pyrotechnics. When people are kind of talking about,
burning crosses on various literary websites.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Should be done with you. Have you been getting, like, serious,
Oh, yes. No, I get hate mail. I truly get, like, I mean, I wake up to hate mail, you know?
Like, how much do you get generally?
Well, it's tapered a bit since kind of the fall. In the summer, I was getting like 5 or 6 a day.
Oh, okay.
I had
that,
like...
I've gotten about that much when I write something inflammatory.
Okay,
so you and I are buds
nice,
here.
Nice. I like it. Yeah. And I mean, it just sort of, it was weird, you know, because it actually kind of became integrated into my day. You know, it was like...
the routine of responding to hate mail.
Yeah, it's like, you know, make my coffee, see who wants to kill me, like move my bowels, you know, and go to Pilates.
Maybe it's the best way is to just check your ale when you're moving your bowels.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
it's on the phone.
Right?
It's the best way to deal with it in that position.
It's funny,
if you're
going
to get shit, you may as well expel it.
Right. Yeah, I never
responded. Well, we got scatological pretty quick.
Sorry, that's
no.
Hazard of having a conversation with me.
Or me.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, partially, like, once I really sort of got into her voice, like, once that template was kind of, like, melded into my brain, I mean, I really feel like, you know, she just rode me around like a horse, and I was just, you know... crawling on my knees in a dog collar, you know, like, yes, Celeste, okay, Celeste, you know, I will, Celeste. Like, I mean, it wasn't, you know...
You couldn't just manage the character and say, no, you know what, Celeste, you can do whatever you want, but you ain't gonna get me.
No. Yeah.
Really?
Huh. No, I mean, I just felt like I had to submit, you know, to her truly. But I mean, kind of one of the conversation aspects, you know, that sort of the book has kind of sparked are sort of, you know, on one camp, you know, it's literature must be redemptive.
Yes.
Right? And if it is not redemptive, it shouldn't be written about. Right?
Yeah.
Or like,
yeah.
You know, it's a worthless book. Yeah. Right. And then on the other side, you know, it's people who can see worth, right, yes, in a book that is not redemptive,
you know. That has no moral compass whatsoever.
That has zero moral compass.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that is what I felt to do, you know, I had to do, particularly kind of, you know, with the subject, with a female protagonist, particularly as a female writer. You know, I mean, I just felt like the expected trajectory to write about the situation, you know, would be to, you know, do it dramatically and with sympathy, you know, and have some kind of, you know, level of rationalization, right, that would be easily digestible for readers, you know, which is exactly why I felt, you know, I can't do any of that, right? I have to do the opposite, you know, because, I mean, I don't even think people would blink, you know. It's just so that conversation's already out there, you know, we were already sort of talking that line, you know, to its, I think, and, you know, thus far, unproductive end, you know, and I wanted, you know, I wanted to sort of do something that would, you know, kind of shake up, you know, the patterns, you know, that we've seemed to have fallen into in kind of talking about this behavior.
At the risk of possibly objectifying you, I still have this image of you on all fours basically answering to Celeste's orders. I'm curious to know more about what this was like.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're the author. You say what goes. You can push back against a character's whims, or you can go ahead and say, yeah, do it. It's not going to affect me. I'm wondering why you felt you were basically the bottom here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, intellectually, what you're saying makes perfect sense. But that was not how it felt to me. Like, that was not how she felt to me. And, I mean, I really was a wreck. I mean, I didn't... It was not uncommon, you know, for me to just, like, you know, work on the manuscripts like 8 or 9 hours a day, you know, not leave the house, not eat except for coffee, you know, just kind of like manic, you know. And my, you know, my partner would kind of come home and we'd be talking, you know, and he's like, where are you? And I mean, it would take me a while to get out from under. I mean, it's like she like slipped me roofies on the regular.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that's how it felt. You know, I'm like, what happened? Where am I? You know, I have these like hazy, disturbing images in my head of, you know.
Did she cause you to wake up on a park bench somewhere in Cleveland? Or
luckily, it didn't go that far. But
so you do have some control against Celeste.
I think that if I had resisted her, she would have shown me zero mercy, I would have woken up on a Greyhound bus having urinated all over myself.
You would have knocked on this door, right, and we would have had to check you in somewhere. No, I mean, but this is fascinating to me because, you know, some writers are able to manage this kind of intense emotional creature that comes from within.
Right.
And some writers either totally become it and become an asshole for about 9 months.
Yeah.
You know, did you become an asshole? I mean, see, or were you kind of in between here? I mean, what do you think caused such a imposing being to just come out like this, just continual? I mean, it's a bit like acting, I suppose.
It is. And I mean, I felt like, I mean, I think acting's a really great kind of, you know, parallel for this particular project.
Yeah.
I mean, because more than any other, you know, sort of thing that I've worked on, I mean, you know, going like into her like extreme mind, you know, really seemed like a role. You know, I mean, I just sort of felt like I was like a medium, you know, kind of like during the times that I was writing.
You're the Sylvia Browne of literature.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, you know, in some ways, I think I almost had to do that, like psychologically, to stay safe myself, you know, because, I mean, because it's not, you know, it's not, the book is not sunshine and teddy bears, you know, like the book is not a rabbit gif, you know.
But the weather is nice in Tampa.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it was almost sort of this like insulation, you know, of like, okay, you know, okay. Like, you know, do whatever you want, you know, let's just hurry this up, you know, let's get on with it, you know. And I mean, never have I kind of felt, you know, sort of the urgency. I mean, because I really wasn't allowed to kind of be myself very much, you know, and during that time, I mean, I didn't turn, I turned like just very quiet.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of like, you know, PTSD, you know, and I'm just like, I'm going to sit in the corner and drink and be traumatized from what I did all day today and all day every day this week. And you guys, you go on with your party, you know, I'm going to look at, you know, the paint on the wall.
Did you ever have a moment where Celeste actually came out of your mouth at all? like, you know, did you, I mean.
Well, one thing that did happen more, because she's very judgmental and catty of other adults, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did find myself writing these super mean jokes in my head about others. And I did occasionally find myself, like, laughing at them,
yeah,
like, a little bit on the inside. I mean, which isn't something I normally do. I mean, I actually, you know, try extremely hard to be sort of a very positive and good person.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that was a little bit like, it's rubbing off, you know.
Yeah, but I know horror writers, and mm-hmm, they are possibly the nicest writers of all time.
Exactly.
Because they're getting it all out,
right,
through their fiction. And I see a lot of literary writers who just become complete passive-aggressive dicks.
Yeah.
And it's because they're not exactly summoning their core, because they have to write such, you know, florid prose.
Right.
And write the important American novel.
Right.
And the kind of writer who prefers to have written as opposed to someone who enjoys writing, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. You mentioned that we were talking about the similarities of writing and acting, and actually,
yeah,
this leads me to ask about the similarities between acting and teaching,
mm,
because both of them rely very highly on a memory. A teacher has to remember all the students, and of course, you know, an actor has to remember, you know, all these lines.
Yeah.
And what's interesting with Celeste is that she's doesn't really have a very good memory. I mean, she can't really remember the students.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow she is more functional than the other teachers in this school. And,
right,
and I'm wondering, you know, how much you related to that notion of having a porous memory as an occupational advantage.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because she just doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, if she's not sexually attracted to a student, she does not care what that student's name is.
Yeah.
Does not care to learn it, you know, despite the fact she'll see that student every day. Doesn't care about teaching,
yeah,
right, in terms of giving information to anyone. She just wants to have these classroom discussions about sex,
yeah,
you know, that are thinly veiled, right, through this like pretense of discussing books. You know, so I mean, it was funny. I love teaching, you know, and I love, it's so funny because I mean, you know, the students, like, they're hungover and they're tired, you know, and you know, they want to be on their phone, you know, and I mean, I just find it hilarious to be like 400%, you know, bubbly, you know, to just like go in the classroom, you know, like it's the Super
Bowl.
How
we doing today?
Yeah. I don't know. I like to do it. So yeah, I mean, I just like, I have a baby, I get up at like, you know,
yeah,
5 a.m., you know, by 9:30, I am like, you know, I've climbed the mountain, you know, I'm caffeinated, I'm perky, and they are like, you know, 10 minutes ago, they were literally asleep, you know, like they've just kind of stumbled into class, and I like it. You know, and I am lucky before I had a child, I had a great memory. I don't know if that comes back or not, but
maybe you actually, and I see this with some parents during the first like 5 to 8 years of the,
yeah,
kid. It's almost kind of like having a vacation for your memory. You're
right.
Not, you don't have to remember every single piece of minutia. You don't have to know everything because you're busy taking care of the kid.
Right.
And then when you finally do have that time, it's like, oh my God, I still got it.
So,
you know,
so,
yeah, and not only that, it also causes you to not really take your writing so seriously and just kind of like do it. And I mean, obviously writing should be taken seriously, but
yeah,
it's good that way, you know?
No, that's actually so true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because everything just becomes like something you're doing because you haven't had enough sleep to like take anything seriously. Yeah. You're just getting through it.
Yeah. To go back to the book, Celeste's sexuality, I wanted to talk about this. I mean, it's it's defined almost exclusively in terms of power, ensuring that her victims are underdeveloped.
Yes.
I'd be the sexual yardstick for his whole life, she says midway through the book. And she's taller than the boy that she loses her virginity with.
Yeah.
At the end of the book, it horrifies her to think of these boys as adults. And I don't think that gives anything away.
Right.
She says, the phrase, when I'm in college, made me feel kicked in the skull. I suspect that the horror that most of the readers who are experiencing this book, the naysayers, the 5 to 10 people or whatever who email you, email you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just as much about this idea of women abusing power as it is about a teacher sexually abusing kids.
Sure.
But given the fact that, you know, more women are graduating from college than men, there are more women CEOs, it's absolutely regressive to think that women in power, successful women, wouldn't in fact abuse it. And I'm fascinated by this. Why do you think fiction makes people a little bit more uncomfortable about these gender roles like this? I mean, you know, it makes them more uncomfortable than an endless half-baked concatenation of Slate articles, you know?
Oh, man. Yeah. I think, like, the closest I've come to seeing the apocalypse is, like, Slate article user comments. It's just like,
or Slate articles in general.
Wow.
Yeah.
People are angry. No, I mean, that it's a really good question, you know, and I find that that's true in so many arenas. Like, for Penn, you know, USA, I was writing, an article the other day about, Goosebumps, right, for kind of the banned book month that's coming up, you know, and I mean, it's just comical, you know, that the world we live in. I mean, look at the world we live in, you know, like, look at what happens, you know, sometimes to children in the world we live in, right? And they're, like, losing their shit over, you know, a book called, like, the Cuckoo Clock of Doom, you know? And it's just kind of like, you know, aren't there greater horrors and terrors to focus your energy on?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think, you know, I think that those people, you know, art is probably the sanctuary for them, right? And they just feel like, you are pissing on my temple, you know, like, this is my safe place.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, I mean, I don't have a safe place. and maybe, you know, I feel this this irrepressible urge to foist that on others. I don't know. But I mean, I just feel like, to me, you know, even when I was a kid, happy movies made me miserable. Because I'm like, you know, why isn't my family like that?
Yeah.
You know, or why isn't my house like that? Or, you know, why don't people love me the way that kid's loved?
I have always been angered by The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
I've been always been angered by especially obnoxious musicals in which everything is... I mean, I love Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
But it took me a while to actually come around to appreciating musicals, because most of the musicals I was exposed to were just treacly and constantly up... I mean, I love, you know, fun... wonder-inducing stuff, but, you know, some of the stuff is just like, for God's sakes, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, at what point, you know, can't you, isn't there room somewhere in this tapestry for at least a little bit of gloom, you know? I mean, is that so bad?
No, and I mean, actually, you know, gloomy art is the only thing that's ever made me feel better.
Yeah.
You know, because
like angry music too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're like, someone gets it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not crazy. You know, like, someone else sees that everything is messed up.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, to me, it's always been a comfort. And I just, like, I don't know, I don't think that I personally, you know, would feel like a book that was exclusively happy or, you know, it just wouldn't feel authentic to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, you know, I just kind of find, I personally kind of get way more out of, like, explorations of pain, you know, than I do kind of occasions for celebration.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think that grosses a lot of people out.
Well, I mean, why do you think it seems to have cropped up these days? I was talking recently with Chiesa Lehman about this problem of cultural engagement, how... You know, people only want to listen to music or experience art almost as if it's in the background. Mm-hmm. They never want to actually understand what the origins of something is. You know, the stories behind it.
Right.
The pain and suffering that came from it. They take that all for granted, and this is one of the reasons why we're in this mess. I mean, why do you think... I mean, I look at what you're doing, and I think back to some of A.M. Holmes's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And she was doing far more extraordinary things that worked people up.
Yeah,
you're talking basically... I mean, I don't want to say that, oh, well... It's just a teacher who's sleeping with boys. What's the big deal? I mean, but by comparison of what novels and fiction used to do, and some of like the David Foster Wallace stories that are so violent, you know, this is really nothing.
Yeah.
Why are we growing more reactionary in terms of art, or in terms of rather receiving art?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think that's true, and I don't know if it's that, you know, we've like turned into such a kind of distraction culture, you know, where it's like, I mean, anything that demands, you know, your full attention is seen as, you
know,
highly suspicious.
How dare you make me think?
Well, yeah. And how dare you limit me, you know, like how am I, you know, supposed to laugh at King of Queens, you know, like when I'm reading this troublesome thing, Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think that that's kind of another problem, you know, that some people have with it. It's not sort of a book where you can kind of like chuckle and turn out the light, you know, and have like a very, you know, peaceful, like ambient level sleep. You know, I mean, it, you know, I think a lot of people are like that's kind of the position that they've given art in their life, right? It's just this kind of like supplementary puzzle piece.
I wanted to, just to show that there's so much going on in your book, I wanted to talk about some of the side characters.
Sure.
You have Janet Feinlog, this fellow teacher. She's not especially good, but Celeste actually, like, takes her on and tries to improve her. You also have this one student, the annoyingly theatrical Marissa Talbot. At the beginning of one chapter, Celeste remarks upon the side rolls of her stomach. She also notices side rolls with Janet when she gives her a ride home. And, you know, it is interesting to me that when she is trying to deal with people in a non-sexual capacity, she absolutely pinpoints on their corporeal forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of the keys to understanding that there's more going on than simply a teacher abusing her power. And I wanted to ask you about how that notion of objectifying as a way of blocking your own feelings, blocking your own positive feelings developed, and how this was a strategy for you to create a little world here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Celeste herself is kind of a self-aware object, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, she's kind of this character, you know, where it's like, if you took all of kind of the cultural messages that are thrown at women, and you took a woman who actually, like, took everyone to heart, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think in a lot of ways she would be Celeste, right? You know, she is, you know, has kind of this socially desired level of physical perfection. And I mean, she kind of operates within it so exclusively, you know, and sees it as, you know, the kind of very literal key, you know, to getting everything that sort of she wants in life. You know, that it's sort of this, you know, tool of superiority, right, that she kind of wields against everyone else that she meets. You know, and I mean, I think that honestly that's what we're kind of told, you know, like as women in our society. I know that that's been my experience as a female, you know, this feeling that, you know, the way that you look is the very most important thing about you. You know, whatever you know, whatever you learn, whatever you accomplish, whatever you do, you know, however kind you are, it's secondary.
Yeah.
You know, that if you're, you know, if you're beautiful enough, you know, no matter how, you know, silly or dangerous or stupid or any other pejorative thing you are, you can achieve, you know, like, fame and, you know, adoration.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that was kind of something I really wanted to engage with, you know, kind of in this novel, you know, of sort of you know, here's a woman who meets, you know, kind of our highest social expectation, you know, for women. She excels at it, you know, and she's a monster.
Yeah.
Right. But it doesn't matter because she meets that goal, you know, and to me that was a really important aspect of the novel, just kind of the social context that allows women like this. I mean, because it happens, you know, when these cases come up and, you know, get picked up by the national media, you know, it's attractive, you know, young women teachers who are then sexually fetishized.
Yeah.
Right. And it achieves this kind of level of celebrity, you know, we're not talking about them as criminals, you know, we're certainly not taking them seriously as criminals.
The TV pundit near the end who says, you know, if you were a young man, would you sleep with her? Of course you would. You know, it just really puts a kind of preposterous spin on something where you're trying to reckon with the horror and you're trying to reckon with why someone would do that. And this actually leads me to ask you about one curious thing that no one has really picked up on.
Yeah.
Celeste doesn't talk about her parents.
No.
We don't know anything about her parents.
We do not.
And that, to me, is so intriguing.
Yes.
Because it suggests to me that whatever forged Celeste is too dark for her to talk about.
Mm.
Or it could just be you, Alyssa, basically saying, no, you don't get an explanation. She just is. But you know, to approach this kind of thing without that kind of parental legacy, I mean, that must have been difficult as you were all on all fours when she was commanding you. You know, I mean, how do you... You know, I have some ideas as a reader of how you deal with something without explanation.
It's right.
Much like a zombie movie. The best zombie movies don't have an explanation.
Right,
but
right.
As a writer, how do you deal with someone who doesn't have an explanation?
Yeah, she, you know, I mean, I worried that, first of all, I think any explanation I gave, you know, for Celeste being who she is, you know, would just be immediately kind of jumped on as... Oh, you know, not only, okay, this is why she's doing it, but also take on this kind of, like, grand metaphorical, you know, like, Alyssa Nutting is saying that this is why, right?
Yeah,
like, female
yeah.
teachers who sleep with their students do it, right?
Whatever you offer, however level-headed, you are basically fucked.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, A. B, I mean, kind of like, as you mentioned, all of kind of my favorite male monsters, you know, Hannibal Lecter, right, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that it kind of, it troubles sort of your perception of them as a monster, right, because it's such a humanizing detail,
yeah.
right? Like, you know, I mean, just the fact that you have parents, right, who ostensibly, you know, in some form love you, you know, and did their best, you know, hopefully at least, you know, that's a very humanizing detail. And, you know, especially I think in our culture, being a daughter,
yeah.
right, is such a powerless role so often. You know, and I really didn't want to compromise her character with that. You know, it was important to me that there was no one, you know, that kind of in any way could trigger her Achilles heel, you know, except sort of the boys who kind of tempt her libido.
You
know, I wanted that to be her only kind of weakness.
Sure.
Well,
I mean, on this subject, I do have to mention this. There is a prosecutor near the end of the book, Delaney, spelled like Samuel R. Delaney. Now, this is quite intriguing for a number of reasons. Specifically, Delaney, you know, he put out this idea of pornotopia, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
Where basically, this is the porn world. People will have sex, and there'll be no explanation. They'll just suddenly do it. And he did this to rather eye-popping effect in Mad Men, and of course,
right.
you know, this big guy through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, if this helped you to get at Celeste's character. Was Delaney some sort of influence in the background? Because you don't just name a character Delaney without the E, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I also, you know, definitely wanted to kind of invoke that, level of chaos, right? Because I feel, too, that that's, you know, usually kind of when it's, you know, applied towards women, like, they're just crazy, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, what's the Glenn Close movie?
Fatal Attraction.
You're right, yeah. You know, I mean, that's what it is, you know, and I don't know. I wanted also, you know, to give her kind of libido, this, you know, this uninfluenced, right,
yeah,
freedom of just like, she, you know, she wants to do it, right? She's doing it for no other reason than that she wants to do it. That was also really important to me.
Yeah. Well, did you actually consult the Delaney stuff at all? Or?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, no, I wanted to be clear on that.
Yeah.
He doesn't get nearly enough credit for it.
I know.
Another,
and he's so right. I mean,
yeah, I know.
Like, I think ahead of his time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
All come true.
It's also really bizarre that there was a time during the 70s in which you could publish something like Dahlgren and it would sell like a million copies.
Right.
So, man, I love that book.
Yeah.
Teachers at the mercy of No Child Left Behind. The policies of Assistant Principal Rosen.
Mm-hmm.
The school kids are bound by this anti-PTA contract.
Mm-hmm.
I'm unaware of any document that highly specific that cracks down on public displays of affection like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, you know, are there any real life precedents for the educational world that you portrayed in this? I mean, at one point, the teacher says, circus animals here to give the taxpaying parents an entertaining evening.
Right.
That is the relationship that they have.
Yeah.
You know, did you consider at any point turning this into almost a kind of muted political novel at all? Or?
I mean, I find that kind of the, you know, there's a certain amount, and I felt this at least in high school as a student, you know, it just felt like, I mean, absurdity was like running down the walls like paint, you know? and I mean, we had these teachers who, you know, I had some great teachers too, but, it was like so clear, like their midlife crisis was just so punctual and comprehensive, right? And we could see them in the cloud of it, right? And we could smell when they were hungover, you know, and when they told us about their divorce, it was not a shocker. You know, so I mean, I really kind of wanted to infuse that absurdity, you know, kind of into this scholastic, you know, framework, you know, because I mean, I think, gosh, education, you know, I mean, my heart like implodes, you know, if I think about it too much. You know, I mean, we need to pay teachers so much money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that needs to be like a national priority, right? Getting like the best possible people in there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, instead it's like either, you know, you get the rare sort of martyrs, right, who are just willing, you know, to kind of literally live on the poverty line,
you know,
and do what they, you know, love to do. But I think more often, right, it's just kind of a brief landing pad, you know, for people who don't care a lot, you know, or, you know, people just kind of fall into it and resent their life and take it out on the students every single day.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly had those teachers where it's like, man, you don't want to be here.
Yeah.
I had one teacher in high school. There was a guy cutting like the grass outside, right? And he pointed and he was like, if I made the same amount of money doing that, I would be out of here in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, and we were all kind of like, okay, you know, I mean, the room just kind of fell silent because it's like, well, what do you say when your teacher admits like he hates teaching, you know? You know, yeah, he would rather deal with a fire ants.
Yeah.
You know,
but even in the days where we grew up with teachers, I mean, teachers don't have that kind of freedom to basically insult the students anymore because, you know, you have kids whipping out their phones.
Oh,
you
right,
they're
right.
talking to their parents. And
right.
now teachers are under this kind of weird surveillance state as well. So
that's true.
Not only do you get paid shit, but you also are, you know, constantly at the beck of call of, you know, being written up, and also No Child Left Behind, things like that. So it's truly
That's super true. And I mean, I think, you know, I know certainly another thing that I've heard has changed kind of over the landscape, kind of in, you know, junior high and high school settings are, you know, it's kind of gone from parents being angry at students for getting bad grades, and like the anger goes to the teacher.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like you almost don't even want to get bad grades because you're just inviting, right, this like world of trouble for yourself.
Yes.
You know, particularly like if their parents are, you know, powerful people in the community, or, you know, very wealthy, or, you know, good friends with the principal, or yada, yada, yada. I mean, it's just a landmine, you know, and I mean, it floors me that, you know, that I don't know, we've let it come to this and don't seem to be at all looking to truly remedy it.
Well, there's one thing that you do in the book which I find really interesting. You have, Celeste, at the beginning, she says that she traded in her classics degree for an education one.
Right.
Which is interesting. But the way that people talk about books in this book is so fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
The kids are actually quite willing to engage with literature. That's what's amazing. You have Trevor, who says that Hamlet is his favorite because it's the most realist.
Mm-hmm.
There's this effort to find modern day comparisons with The Scarlet Letter.
Right.
But the teachers, they don't give a damn.
Right.
You have Celeste describing Lord of the Flies as a Christmas story. Which is really ridiculous. I guess like Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
Right.
Janet teaches The Pit and the Pendulum, but doesn't actually understand it.
Right.
I'm wondering, was the idea here to investigate the educational possibilities that are being stifled, or to make the kids smarter and more curious than the adults?
Yeah. I mean, I think I really wanted to highlight, you know, I mean, Celeste's clear apathy, right? For, I mean, often, you know, there are one or two scenes where the, you know, students are like, are we going to talk about this now, right? Or, you know, like, are we going to get on course in this way?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what are you doing, basically? You know, and kind of the same thing with Janet, you know, just sort of, you know, these are two people who are not up to the occasion, you know, and I really kind of wanted to show that.
Yeah.
Huh.
I wanted to also talk about the shock collar fantasy. And the teacher who ends up going crazy, to some degree, these almost operate as red herrings to kind of suggest to the reader, well, you know, a stressful environment like school is kind of responsible for these baleful indiscretions.
Mm.
Or, you know, was this an intent to suggest that our worst fantasies can be just as bad as someone like Celeste, who has a true sexual disorder?
Yeah, I think that kind of, you know, I wanted to make it really clear that, like, she got, you know, she chose education as, like, a dating service, right? I mean, she's like, I need, you know, to, like, jump in the pool, you know, and this is where it's at, you know, like, pipeline me straight to ninth grade.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, I think...
Pretendle.
Right. You know, I think kind of, you know, with sort of especially like the other, you know, teachers in this just kind of boilerplate, you know, atmosphere. I liked the juxtaposition, right? That sort of, you know, there are these adults who themselves feel very vulnerable, and very abused, right? And very picked upon. And then kind of the teacher who really wants to be there, like doesn't want to be there to educate, you know, wants to be there like for her own sexual perversity.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as the students go, it's pretty lose-lose. Yeah. Which, you know, which this is no way a book that suggests, you know, there aren't great teachers out there, you know, but it is a book that suggests, you know, I mean, I think we're just not kind of valuing education the same, you know, the way that we need to be, like in our society. I mean, I really think that sort of, you know, teachers should kind of be up there with, you know, doctor, lawyer, you know, like, I mean, this needs to be sort of the social standing of teachers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hell of a gig. You know, I teach college because I could not handle, you know, I don't think I couldn't do it well, you know, to teach high school or junior high. I mean, it's so much work. Yeah. I can't imagine the amount of work that it is. And, you know, I mean, I have such deep respect for people who do it well. But, you know, since this is kind of in many ways a critical satire, I wanted to talk about the people who don't do it well.
Yeah.
So that's why I highlighted them.
So Celeste offers this one metaphysical proposition, this sentiment. The soul had always struck me as being a tricky thing to keep with the body. An easily bored aristocrat with the means to leave whenever it wished. And I wanted to talk about something you do in your writing. You are very fond of these metaphors, as well as these sort of Chandler-esque similes that often just kind of come out of the blue. And I'm wondering, you know, is this kind of an offshoot of some of the surrealism you did in your stories? Is this a way for you to find some kind of unexpected behavioral parallel through language? I mean, there is a very curious exploration here whenever I see a like or as. Like, okay, here's Alyssa going to do it again. And I wanted to ask you about this. And the risk, of course, is that this becomes a crutch. But, you know, right. How does language work like this for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm such a sentence reader. I'm such a sentence reader. And I feel like you have to write what you read in some ways, you know, that, I mean, that's where kind of your strengths are. That's kind of what makes you passionate about writing and the reason that, you know, you would do it even if no one read it,
yeah.
You know, the same, you know, kind of reason that, you know, bands will suffer in poverty and obscurity rather than pump out, you know, a pop tune, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it would just feel like, you know, they were stabbing themselves repeatedly, right? In like the chest and eyes and genitals and, you know, again and again and again and again.
You want to avoid the pop song.
Yeah.
And that's where the simile comes in.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's just like when I'm reading, that is what like kicks me in the brain, you know, every time, just sort of this metaphor, you know, that I never would have thought of, you know, or this comparison between two things that I never would have linked up, but that rings immediately true the moment I hear it.
Yeah.
I mean, to me that, you know, personally, that's 90% of the fun of reading, you know? So, I mean, I think it's what I appreciate in literature and therefore kind of what I seek to emulate, I guess.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm wondering, you know, is it a way of, I guess, triggering the subconscious or priming it to some degree? Because sometimes it just happens.
Yeah.
But in your case, it happens through the simile, and that's what makes it interesting. It's like the other parts of, you know, of your stories often have these sentences in which it's driving the narrative forward.
Right.
But then the simile comes up and suddenly it turns it in another direction where it presents a possibility and maybe overdrafts, it's kind of burnished down, but I can still see it in reading your stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I still would really describe myself as mainly a fabulist writer.
Yeah.
You know, and that might sound odd having just written kind of a ostensibly realist novel. But I mean, I think there's just as much kind of fantasy, you know, in the novel as there was in my short story collection. It's just in her thoughts rather than actually happening.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, I don't know, to me also, I tend to love first person so much, you know, just to sort of have that like immediate access to the character's thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, kind of one of the most interesting things in any given scenario is the contrast of what someone's thinking versus what they're saying or doing or how they're acting. I'm just so interested in kind of facades and, you know, pretense and, you know, sort of, you know, social conforming behavior that you can kind of adopt and put on like a hat and take off, you know, and put on another hat. And that, you know, that also really lets me sort of display it. And I think it's also kind of what I tend to do. I had a really boring childhood and we went to church a lot.
Ah.
So I had what
church did you go to?
A Catholic.
Oh, yes. Much so, like John Waters.
Yes. Yeah. So I had a lot of time, you know, that I had to entertain myself in my mind, right? And I had to be like, you know, praying or sitting still or being quiet you know, so, I mean, I would just have these kind of, you know, I would go on these thought vacations. So I think I like to give my characters thought vacation simply because it's like one of the only ways I know of being in the world. So it's hard for me to imagine a character without also imagining what they imagine.
Are you still Catholic? Do you still go to church? Or?
No, I mean, I work at a Jesuit, you know, university. And I mean, I think one of the reasons that I do and I like it so much is that there is that kind of bridge of familiarity for me, you know, like there's something very home-like about it to me, but it's still liberal, you know, enough that kind of it's not sort of the judgment, you know, that home actually was. But no, I'm not. I don't practice. And my husband was raised Catholic as well.
Oh, interesting.
But he doesn't practice, so.
Lapsed Catholics, the
third. Yeah, we're two of them, yeah. Well,
but at the same time, I mean, you know, America has, it is always going to be indebted in some way, whether we like it or not, to religious language.
Yeah.
And to religious principles.
Definitely.
And even if you're, you know, as off the charts atheist as I am, you still have to wrangle with that if you want to actually have a relationship to words. And and that, I think, is sometimes what separates like the real writers from the people who are just kind of in it to tell a story, which is fine and everything. But, but I mean, I'm wondering, has that kind of ever been a kind of creative predicament for you in terms of fiction or anything like that? Or?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because to me, like the way that I experienced religion in others was as like, that is their obsession, you know? Like, up to a certain age, up to, like, 6 or 7, I constantly really thought in my head, I'm like, you know, one day we're going to have the conversation, you know, me and my parents, where we all acknowledge together how we're pretending.
Yeah.
You know, like we're pretending to believe.
Suddenly the national holiday will be announced. Okay, everybody, we're going to reveal all the lies, all the mythology. It will all be explained. Just continue to go ahead and pretend.
Yeah. And like, finally I realized my mother, who's like the most kind of hardcore, right? I'm like, I realized, oh my God, she's not pretending, but I still had hope for my father. And then there was one weekend when she was out of town. Yeah. So I figured, and I'd never miss, when I, like from birth to 18, the only Sunday I ever was allowed to miss church was when I had the chicken pox.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, so I kind of got excited because, you know, I was like a little bit older.
Just imagine if you had typhus.
Right. Yeah. No, they would have put me in like a bubble suit and rolled me in. But yeah, and I was like, oh, you know, I bet he's going to do it. I bet he's going to, you know, say we don't have to go to church.
Yeah.
And he was totally like, we got to go to church. What are you doing? You know, and I was just like, shit, you too? You know, and I mean, I just had this feeling of kind of every, you know, of being so different from everyone around me. Sometimes, it, you know, like it was sort of this defective, right, feeling, like what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And then other times it was like a what's wrong with them? You know, like they're, you know, they act to me like they're brainwashed. And, you know, it really made me sort of understand prioritizing one thing dogmatically. And I think that, you know, particularly for Celeste, you know, that kind of really fed into her character, you know? I mean, like, her religion is like 14-year-old cock, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I understood what that would look like in her life, you know, because I understood sort of what obsessions are to people, you know, and
all
how
all you have to do is look at that staple.
right. How pervasive, right?
Yeah.
How pervasive they are kind of through every aspect of their life. You know, because I mean, you know, my mother, I mean, like she, like God would come up, you know, like before we went to see a movie, right? Or before every meal, you know, I mean, I really kind of could understand this lens, you know, so it was just sort of a matter of, you know, taking off, right, the Catholicism glasses and putting on the pedophile glasses.
That's amazingly interchangeable, my goodness. But, you know, and it turns out that it's not interchangeable in some cases, too.
Right.
So much for non-overlapping magisteria there. I don't want to give away the ending of the book, but it is interesting that in your case, throwing a kid into an intense sexual relationship results in violence and intense obsession.
Yeah.
You know, this is amazing to me. You know, of course, this assumes we can fully believe Celeste.
Right.
But, you know, Celeste sort of suggests previous abuse that she's initiated. But for someone who seems to think that she really has control over everybody, you know, I'm wondering why you designed her as someone who couldn't always see the way that things worked out. Did you hedge your bets against making Celeste too calculating, or?
Well, I mean, I think that that's what obsession does,
yeah.
You know, and I think that it was kind of important, right, to show that, you know, that sort of that is her weakness, right? You know, in getting what she wants and in pursuing what she wants, she sometimes is unable, right, to kind of be as objective, right, or as prepared,
yes,
as she thinks she is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did feel like that was important. I you know, because I don't think she'd see everything coming. I think that at times she would just be too in the moment or too unwilling to admit, right, what was,
yeah,
fully going on.
But there's also this sense that the teachers teach behavior more than knowledge, at least from Celeste's perspective. There's the moment where Jack asks Celeste, "Are you married?" And Celeste replies, "Adult relationships are complicated." You know, I'm wondering if really this is now what kids are taking away from teachers. It's not so much a guide to open your mind, to instill a sense of curiosity, to draw fascinating connections, to have a sense of play. It's really about, you know, little tetchy models like that on how to be an adult, and which, you know, by the way, is a bad idea all around, because you have to figure this out on your own.
Right,
you know,
right.
I'm curious about the, you know, why the teachers are more behavior oriented in terms of their pedagogy than info based.
Yeah, I mean, I think Celeste certainly is, because she doesn't care about the info.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think that's interesting. That's an interesting point. I don't know. It's different because I do teach adults, you
yes.
know. But, you know, perhaps that is something that's kind of closer to me, that kind of permeated into the novel. I'm very upfront about that, you know, like in my courses and with my grading, you know.
Yeah.
You know, part of kind of this course, you know, is dependent upon behavioral expectation,
yeah.
You know, and you will have a lower grade if you're constantly late, or if you're not participating,
yeah.
or if your things aren't turned in on time, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, part of sort of your success in this course is dependent on, you know, your behavior matching, right, the behavior of kind of a responsible, engaged citizen and participant, you know, and then with Celeste, I think it's somewhat the opposite,
yes.
Right? You know, and in some ways, I think she's almost attempting to match or pretend at adolescent behavior, right?
Yeah.
To kind of seem more like to them, right? To have her odor, right, not seem foreign, you
yeah.
know, to kind of their young noses.
She is very dictated by the smell of breath and that kind of thing, which is really what dictates the sign of whether she should investigate further.
Right,
between
right.
boys and men. I also wanted to ask you about the Celeste and Jack relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not really that much of a spoiler or whatever,
no.
but it is, oddly enough, very much defined by food, like smearing holiday leftovers
yeah.
over them.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about this. I mean, was this a way of trying to add a little bit of humor, to lighten it in some way? Or were you more interested in exploring a kind of insouciant perversity of some kind? I'm wondering about this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is funny, right? Which
yeah.
doesn't hurt. You know, and I think it also sort of shows the very low half-life, right,
yeah.
that kind of these relationships have, you know, where a few weeks after we've, you know, sort of begun the behavior, you know, she's having to kind of go to these lengths to, you know, to keep it interesting for
yeah.
her, right? But I mean, I think it also, you know, just on a really kind of primary level, you know, was just sort of this direct, you know, consumption metaphor, you know, as well. I mean, she understands, you know, her role as kind of sexual object in society, and she kind of turns that lens very coldly at these boys,
yeah,
you know, and completely objectifies them. So, I mean, it seemed appropriate, right, that she would kind of delight in anything that made them more tangibly edible, right?
Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, when you introduce something like this, even if it's a metaphor,
mm-hmm,
there runs the risk of not really looking at this in this sort of really horrific light, because it is horrific.
Yeah.
What she does to Jack and what he will have to live with for the rest of his life is very serious stuff. So when you go ahead and introduce something like the food thing,
mm-hmm,
you know, there's that aspect. I'm wondering, Alyssa, if you were almost, I mean, I'm wondering if it was a no-win situation. Could you play it both ways? Did you try to actually make it more horrific? Was it even possible to do both horrific and comedic at the same time? Or?
Well, I mean,
it is horrific on a general level, but
right,
I'm talking about really stuff that would just absolutely drop the jaw of someone who is, you know, who reads a lot of this kind of stuff, you know?
Right, right. I mean, you know, to answer kind of the comedy horror, you know, I mean, I think comedy is the scariest thing in the world.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
I mean, I think, yeah, so yes, I think that's possible, but you know, my primary kind of directive, I felt, was to stay true to Celeste's perspective.
Yeah.
Right? And Celeste is certainly not, you know, perceptive,
yes,
of kind of the level of horror. I mean, you know, this is kind of her entertaining herself. You know, it's not sort of her witnessing Heart of Darkness, right?
Yeah.
You know, but I did try just kind of in sort of Jack's objective behavior,
yeah,
right? To kind of pull the curtain back on that horror, you know, of kind of what this actually does to, you know, him as a person.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she sees him as an object, you know, and from the very kind of first initiation, he was something disposable to her. You
yeah
know, I mean, she started it with the intention of, you know, very, very soon, you know, as soon as she's finished chewing, you know, spit him out.
But I mean, I guess, and maybe I'm making a modest critique here.
Okay,
but, you know, we see that Celeste refuses Jack's gifts.
Yes.
And then, of course, he's driven to desperation with this act later on,
yes,
to sort of memorialize the relationship. I won't say what it is.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering if you were kind of damned if you do or damned if you don't, because you're writing from first person,
right,
is it even possible to portray that objective behavior that would really allow us to see the full horror of the consequences of this relationship?
Well, I don't think that it's possible for Celeste to be objective,
yeah,
about sex with boys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think her obsession precludes that clarity.
Yeah.
So I didn't personally feel that was possible.
Yeah.
No.
Well,
yeah.
At least not yet in your career. Maybe later on. Do you think that's some sort of mountain you want to climb, or is that, or you've gotten a lot of it out of your system with this book?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I could definitely see myself writing a different book about a different character who was a monster, but I mean, you know, it's funny because oddly, I think that had I done that, I think that would have opened a weird window into actual sympathy for her as well, you know, because I think that kind of if she's noticing, right,
yeah,
or if she can care enough, right, to truly perceive, right,
yeah,
like, oh my God, I am damaging another individual so fully and so completely, that kind of means that her conscience, right, is on top of the surface, right, at least poked its head out of its shell, right,
yeah,
for a moment, right? poked its head out and was like, ah, what the hell are you doing? And then went back in.
But people do that. And maybe that might have even creeped out readers further, that they would actually feel sympathy for a monster, much as they have with, Humbert.
No, I know. I just didn't want to go there. I felt like there
was... You were on all fours after all.
Well, I felt like there was a predictable place. You know, I mean, I felt like people were, you know, likely going to read this book sort of like half waiting for the liberal wink, you know, yeah. Kind of like half waiting for the point, you know, when it's like, okay, we're going to talk about how horrible this
is now. It's time to talk about the morality. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. And that was kind of the whole point of Celeste. I mean, to me...
But can't you talk about this kind of thing without it being moral? Can't you just present the behavior that will be interpreted any number of ways and some people will feel sympathy and some people will not?
I mean, I don't... But it's not neutral behavior for her. You know, like, this is like what... drives her, you know, like this is like this extreme catalyst for her, and it's literally like the only thing, right, that that causes her to not be judgmental, right, or gloomy, right. I mean, it's sort of the only space that she has. I just don't think that there would be a way for her to be neutral about it personally. Like, yeah. This is just how I feel about her, you know, and readers are certainly right free to agree or disagree, but I know that to me that would have ruined the whole book if there was a time at which Celeste said, oh my god, right, look at this horrible thing I'm doing, because I wanted her to be soulless. You know, we just don't get female characters without souls who are protagonists.
Yeah.
Right. Hardly ever.
Yeah.
Right. And I really, really wanted to write a book with a soulless female protagonist. That was something that I wanted to do. And, you know, and I mean, I think that it is, you know, it probably is scarier, you know, to people if the character is able, right, to see, like, to know fully, you know, have full awareness of the damage they're inflicting and choose to do it anyway, right, or kind of set that aside for their own interests. But I think that, I don't know, I don't feel that kind of the point of this book is sort of to terrify readers as much as possible, because I mean, I think there are more terrifying things you could have done. Yeah. And we kind of talked about that in the beginning.
Yes,
like,
we did.
Geez, this is, you know, like, yeah, like it's pretty graphic sexually, yeah. But nothing happens in, you know, this book that like probably has not happened before, you know, in real life. You know, and what I really sort of wanted to be clear here were kind of the gendered expectations and the social roles, right, that sort of women have to work with, and what happens when your physical exterior actually meets kind of the zenith of those social expectations.
I'm fascinated by the idea of Celeste being a soulless character, even though the language itself is, I don't think, soulless at all. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons why we can kind of get inside her.
Yeah.
The sentences are laden with soul, laden yeah. with humor, laden with horror, right. Laden with all sorts of ironies and conflicts. And so I'm wondering, this goes back to my original idea about Celeste's parents mm-hmm. not being mentioned. You know, obvious. I mean, it's almost as if the language itself is the real unreliable narrator here.
Yeah, I mean, she certainly feels passion. You know, when I yeah. say soulless, I guess like just like no, like morality is not on her palette. You know yeah. what I mean? Like that's not a tool that she has to work with or cares to work with.
Annoyance, yes, but morality, no.
Right, right, right. You know, so I mean, yeah, it's interesting because, you know, like she's extremely kind of gifted and prolific, right, at sort of insulting others, yeah. right, in kind of the most
peevish and pugnacious ways,
right, and funny, you know, that's a gift for her, but she's not able to kind of turn that gift onto positive or redeeming things.
Yes,
yeah.
I feel compelled to basically talk about the men in this book who all sure. have monosyllabic names. Now, yeah. I have a monosyllabic name, as you know, and I began to worry that I might somehow transform into a poker-playing, cigar-chopping, marinated steak-eating kind of guy.
Yeah.
Beer squilling Visigoth, basically. Mm-hmm. Granted, this is Celeste's perspective, and she's going to see these men these way to justify her own love of boys. But I'm wondering why you didn't push yourself to make Celeste's perception of men a little bit more sophisticated beyond this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, again, kind of this case of, like, what would she notice, right? And what would she not notice? And, I mean, I think kind of for her, like, sort of there's this great almost pleasure in taking what kind of society would value in men, right? This sort of, like, her husband is exceptionally attractive, right? To her, he's repulsive.
Yeah.
Right? And, I mean, I think she, I think that's kind of a prize, you know, for her, the fact that sort of she's not under that spell, right? I mean, to her, it's like this literal form of power,
yeah.
right? That, most women would be fawning over him, right? Most women would be helpless, you know, to resist his advances, you know, or not kind of fall head over heels, yeah. right? You know, to me, he's nothing, right? Yeah. To me, he's worthless, right? I'm kind of, you know, her husband's also wealthy, right? Extremely wealthy from family money. And though she, you know, likes the money and likes spending it and, you know, I mean, it's really another thing that she's kind of just simply using him for, right? She doesn't sort of think of him as a better man because he comes from a rich family, yeah. right? Whereas I think, you know, society would tell us that, yes, like, men who come from rich families are more important, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, I think for her, you know, she really likes to kind of, like, debunk, right, kind of these scenarios of, at least in her husband, you know, of kind of what's supposed to be valued in men versus sort of what she values. You know, and again, I mean, she mostly deals with men that she has to deal with in order to get what she wants.
Yes.
Right? So, I mean, I think that she is sort of by nature going to interact with men that, you know, if she didn't find a man easy to put down, right, or easy to resist, I don't think she'd be very comfortable interacting with him.
Yes. But yes, she also has the pool, which is this place for her to be sort of exhibitionistic, but also, I would argue, mm-hmm. kind of the warm amniotic fluid. Mm. It's a place for her to retreat. Mm-hmm. And this is probably the closest the book gets to offering some kind of parental metaphor, which, and yet, you invert it with the whole exhibitionistic thing.
Yeah.
And you have her husband saying, what are you doing that? You know, and right, covering right, himself right, in shame, which right. gets into sort of biblical sort of situations.
So yeah.
I mean, here's a character who is too terrified to return to the womb. And yet she does. And I'm wondering, I'm wondering if it was even possible to be completely transparent about some of these aspects of her character, or whether you would get in trouble similarly to offering an explanation to readers. Did you try to explore this a little more?
I think it's sort of this double-edged sword yeah. for her, right? Where on one hand it's like, you know, that's what she's sort of supposed to do, right? And I mean, I love these kind of moments with her husband, you know, like I love the moment you pointed out where she's very much conforming, right, to this like social sexual idea, right, of like the dream woman, right?
Yes.
The dream woman wants it all the time. The dream woman greets you, you know, like when you open the door, you know, with like her, you know, bare naked ass in the air,
yeah.
right? Ready for
a
you
very,
to...
A very frequent image.
Ready for you to penetrate her, right? The dream woman, yeah, lounges, you know, around kind of, you know, in her pool nude, right? You know, and then there, but that... You know, that dream image, right, is then butts heads with the dream image of, like, the ideal wife,
yes.
right? So, I mean, you have these kind of two ideals, right, that women are sort of told to aspire to that are very much in contention with one another. You know, and I really sort of I wanted to kind of highlight those, you know, because I think in a way – she loves knowing that this is going to bring out hypocrisy in her husband,
yeah.
right? And she also loves kind of doing it just for herself sometimes, right? This kind of behavior where it's like, if someone saw this, right, it would be their ideal sexual fantasy.
Yeah.
But no one is actually watching now. And who am I when no one's watching me?
Yeah.
Right?
But there's a payoff near the end, which I won't spoil, in which everybody is watching.
Mm.
And it becomes this situation where she's so accustomed to basically being oblivious that it carries on in the particular position where it counts, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, we've batted quite a lot around here, but Alyssa, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, it was wonderful to chat with you. Thanks so much for
Fantastic.
Having me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hello. What's your name?
Diplodocus.